Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And don't forget that you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We'll be hearing from the author of a book called Planetary Health for most of the hour. Towards the end of the hour, as a special surprise treat, an interview out of the Morning Show archives with folk singer Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary, who is singing a digital virtual concert tonight, benefit concert for the uptown neighborhood of Kenosha. That interview with Peter Yarrow coming up later in the hour here on WGTD. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Dr. Samuel Myers, who is a principal research scientist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance. And in the next few minutes, we are going to be exploring this intriguing and important concept of planetary health, how the health of our planet and everything around us has everything to do with our own health as well as human beings and collectively as the human race. And the book at hand, Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves, explores some of the ways in which we are connected with the planet itself and the biosphere, often in ways that we are not even particularly aware of. And the fact that as humankind continues to progress in all kinds of exciting ways and in many beneficial ways, there are also all kinds of ways in which that progress is detrimental to the planet on which we live. And ultimately, some of those detriments, in fact, even now, are beginning to really catch up to us. And more those detriments are going to cancel out the very progress that that all of us want for ourselves and those we care about. That is what is explored in this important book, which is published by Island Press, which is a very significant nonprofit press that shares all kinds of significant books with the world, including this one, again titled Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. This book is actually co-edited by Dr. Myers and by Howard Frumkin and gathers together the writing of a distinguished panel of experts in a variety of fields. Dr. Samuel Myers, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
I am excited to talk with you about this. I think it would be interesting to get a little background on who you are and your own sort of professional history. One of the things that you say, I think it might be in the acknowledgments, in talking about you and your co-editor, Howard Frumkin, is you say, we both trained in medicine and public health, but our intellectual journeys have taken us far afield, from ecology to agronomy, from urban and transportation planning to earth science. Your own kind of intellectual journey, as you describe it, has taken you far afield. Describe a little more about that and how that has happened.
Sure. Well, I'm not a poster child for a linear career path. So I've been sort of wandering around trying to really understand the synthesis between global environmental change and human health for most of my career in a variety of different ways. And in some ways, it's really the story of perpetually kind of moving upstream. So as an undergraduate, I was really interested in medicine and sort of human biology and physiology, but I was also very interested in environmental science and the natural world, and was already sort of wondering how they might be interconnected, and went to medical school at Yale, where there's an excellent school of forestry and environmental science, and spent a lot of my time there. I went to University of California in San Francisco for my internal medicine residency, but midway through residency, through sort of a variety of coincidences, ended up being invited to go to Tibet and lead an integrated conservation and human health project on the north side of Mount Everest for 2 years, and ultimately ended up deciding to go ahead and do that and left residency for 2 years, and then came back and finished residency. So after that, I was at USAID for 2 years in the Global Health Bureau and a conservation organization, Conservation International, running the Healthy Communities Initiative, which also looked at the intersection of environmental conservation and natural resource management with health. And so really for 6 years, I was exploring this intersection of human health and environmental change more at the project level in communities all around the world, and you know, ultimately got really, really interested in the need to build a whole field that really explored how our transformation of nature, how our disruption and degradation of all of our natural systems was coming back to pose what's really an urgent global health threat. In the extent to which our own health and well-being is imperiled by our transformation of nature. And so I came back to Harvard and did my Master's of Public Health and a research fellowship, and I've been doing a lot of research on how changing natural systems actually affects different dimensions of human health for different populations around the world. And somewhere along the way, I also founded the Planetary Health Alliance, which has been growing rapidly over the last 5 years and now includes about 240 organizations in over 40 countries that are all coming together in support of this new field of planetary health.
Hmm. I wonder if we could spend a couple of minutes at least talking about that very term, planetary health. And you devote some time to kind of helping us understand the background of it. And if I understand correctly, the term is relatively new. If I remember correctly, it was, I think you say something about being coined right around the year 2010. But actually, the concept that it represents is a concept that has been around a long time and explored in a lot of different ways. I think at one point you say it has both a short and a very long history. Give us some background on this term of planetary health and what is behind those words.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I think you can go to a lot of faith traditions and indigenous knowledge systems around the world and find concepts of interconnectedness with nature and natural systems that go back, you know, thousands of years. And so the idea that our well-being is sort of tied to the health of our natural systems is not a new idea. But in other ways, planetary health is a very new field. And in fact, it was really only 5 years ago in 2015 that the term planetary health kind of came into public parlance with the publication of a big Rockefeller Lancet Commission report in The Lancet in July of 2015. That was really when that term started to be popularized. And in a lot of ways, it's a field that has emerged in response to a moment. And I think we're in really a unique moment in human history. And what characterizes that moment is the scale and pace of our transformation of nature. And a lot of people understand that, you know, we are and have been for decades sort of affecting environmental conditions, whether it's the climate system or biodiversity or pollution. People understand that environmental disruption is a problem, but what very few people understand is the extraordinary sort of scale and pace of that transformation and the extent to which it's actually a relatively new phenomenon. If you look back at, say, 1950 or 1960, and you look at global patterns of human consumption, whether it's proliferation of cars and trucks or appropriation of water resources or production and use of synthetic fertilizers or paper production or plastic production or primary energy use, what you see is very, very similar curves with pretty modest consumption patterns up until about 1950, and then this really steep, almost exponential acceleration in global human consumption. And not surprisingly, if you look at metrics of our impact on natural systems, so biodiversity loss or global deforestation or addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, you see, again, very, very similar patterns. And the reason they're all so similar is that they're all underlain by these two fundamental processes. One is human population growth. So the human population was about 2.5 billion in 1950, and now it's well over 7 billion. So it's been growing very rapidly. And per capita consumption, the amount of goods and services that each one of us asks our planet to provide for us, has been growing even more steeply than population. And when you multiply those two things together to get sort of global GDP, the total sum of what we're asking the planet to provide, you see this nearly vertical line that we're on that around 1950 just starts to rise very, very, very steeply. And as a result, our the sort of total human enterprise, the sum total of all our collective activities, is now really outstripping our planet's capacity to absorb our wastes or provide the resources that we're using sustainably. And so we're disrupting all of these systems, whether it's the climate system, biodiversity loss, global changes in land use, pollution of air and water and soil, resource scarcity of fresh water and arable land. All of these things are changing really at the fastest rates in the history of our species. And they're interacting with each other in complex ways that we're just starting to understand, but that affect the sort of core conditions for human health and well-being, the quality of the air we breathe, the quality of water we drink, the quantity and quality of food that we can produce, exposure to infectious diseases, exposure to extreme weather events, even the habitability of the places that we live. And so every dimension of human health is being impacted. And so planetary health is arising out of this moment. We often say we're a community forged in urgency in response to these relatively new threats to our own health and well-being.
Right. At one point in the book, you describe this as an extraordinary ballooning of humanity's ecological footprint. So in other words, the impact that we are having on this planet has grown right along with some of the achievements and accomplishments that have made life undeniably better for more and more people, but at a cost that we have not fully gauged or grasped. And that cost is going to begin, and even now, is overtaking some of that progress, which is or has been so important. I mean, it is a cost that we cannot continue to bear.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And there's no question there have been huge improvements in most metrics of human development over the last 70 years. But what we're recognizing is that the trajectory that has taken us from here to there is a fundamentally unsustainable trajectory. And so we're not in any way advocating sort of rolling back the clock, but what we're advocating is finding a way to maintain and extend those gains, but at the the same time significantly reduce our ecological footprint. And that process is what we've been calling the Great Transition, but it requires some pretty serious commitment to doing most of the things that we do in different ways.
We're speaking with Dr. Samuel Myers about the book that he has co-edited with Howard Fremkin entitled Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. We should not probably spend a whole lot of time on this, but early in the book and in an epilogue that was written just before the book was published, you touch on the recent phenomenon of COVID-19. And the reason you take the time to talk about it is because of its relevance to much of what you talk about. And you state quite emphatically that the COVID-19 pandemic is a prototypical planetary health story. In other words, it really clearly exemplifies much of what you explore in this book and many of the concerns raised by the Planetary Health Alliance. Explain to our listeners what some of these connections are, or what it is that we can learn from this COVID-19 pandemic in terms of the health of our planet and ourselves.
Sure. Well, we see the COVID-19 pandemic as the most recent in really a whole series of alarm bells that have been ringing across the planet over the last several years, you know, going back to the hurricane season in the Caribbean a couple of years ago with Maria and Irma that really wiped out several Caribbean nations, and fire seasons that were really extreme in California, and then the Amazon and Siberia, 50 million acres burned in Australia, then the worst locust outbreak in 70 years in Kenya that exacerbated a famine that was already associated with really severe drought patterns, and then this year with the extraordinary hurricane season again, and the hurricanes coming up through the Gulf this time, and a lot of the American West on fire to the extent that the smoke plume extended all the way to here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so we're seeing all of these disasters that have human fingerprints all over them. And the COVID pandemic is just another in that series, obviously one that's very much gotten our attention, as it should. But, its emergence also has human fingerprints on it. It has a lot to do with how we interact with wildlife. And it's one of these sort of unsurprising surprises in the sense that it's been long predicted that if we continue to move into wildlife habitat through extractive industries like logging and mining or agricultural incursions where we're clearing forest for agricultural fields or bushmeat hunting and the wild animal trade, and then these live animal markets like the one in Wuhan in China, that all of these activities create opportunities for what are called spillover events where pathogens can move from animal populations into human populations. And often they move from one animal to another. So in the COVID example, this new virus was probably in a bat. It may well have mutated and moved into another animal, possibly a pangolin, and then jumped to a human population. And part of what made that possible was the bringing together of these different kinds of animal species in close proximity in a way that you don't see in nature. And so in some ways it was a reflection of this very risky relationship we have with the natural world. So its origin story is one of sort of our relationship to nature, but I think even more interesting, there's a lot to learn from the pandemic itself that's relevant to planetary health. One of the things that we've seen, which is actually sort of hopeful, is the capacity for really extraordinary global, very rapid collective behavior change. And, you know, we've never seen anything like this before in human history, where most people all over the world have very quickly and quite radically changed how they're living. And that's the kind of behavior change that we think is going to be important in order to achieve this great transition, that we need to collectively change the way we're living. So it's actually encouraging to see that it's possible. We've also learned that nature recovers and regenerates. And so when industries are, you know, slowing down, when we're driving less, we're seeing air quality get much better. We're seeing wildlife moving back into places where they traditionally used to be because there's less disruption. None of those things are necessarily good things from the standpoint of the global economy, and I'm not advocating them. Obviously, the pandemic's been terrible with respect to lost lives and lost livelihoods, but it's interesting to see in that context how quickly nature can recover. We've also learned that science matters, that you know, the countries that have taken the science seriously have averted a lot of mortality, and countries that have sort of catalyzed skepticism about the science and poo-pooed the science have tended to be places where the highest mortality has occurred. So, you know, that's an important theme for planetary health as well. And finally, we see this opportunity around the stimulus packages. So over the next couple of years, you know, trillions of dollars of all of our tax money is going to be spent to sort of jumpstart global economies and create foreign assistance packages for countries that have really been hammered by the pandemic. And that money has the opportunity to be a huge step forward in assisting this great transition and helping to develop the infrastructure for living differently on Earth. And so there's a real opportunity to hold our governments accountable to make sure that we're not using the money to sort of shore up an old system that is taking us down a path that we don't want to follow.
At one point you say, knowing that massive change is possible gives great hope for a brighter future for planetary health. I think that's very, very well said. We're speaking with the co-editor of a book called Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. Dr. Samuel Myers co-edited this along with Howard Frumkin. Before we explore a few more specifics in the book, I want to share with you something that another guest on this program said very recently about an entirely different book. I'm not going to go into what that book was, but it was written by a naturalist very much dedicated to the well-being of the world around us and so on. You would be very much on the same page. But this particular book was, in a sense, much lighter in nature, in its framework and its approach. And he talks in the preface about how he kind of almost felt the necessity of that to write a book like this and to share a book like this. And in the preface he says, from the outset, I was convinced that this kind of writing wasn't the place for calls for action. A straight diet of exposés and activism is a prescription for burnout. And he wanted this book that he wrote to be, in a sense, a bit of a refuge, not a distraction from the important work that must be done. But I just think he's saying something really kind of important there about how when we are taking on problems and concerns of such massive scale, and problems and concerns that are quite literally a matter of life and death, it is also the kind of effort that in some ways at least can be difficult to sustain, at least on kind of an emotional level. When it comes to the work of you and others in the Planetary Health Alliance, I wonder how much you think about this, or how much these kind of concerns come up about how one goes about this kind of work in such a way in which the people doing the work will not become exhausted or burned out or bitter or hopeless or any number of sort of emotional and mental pitfalls that I think can be part of this.
So, you know, the question about hope and how we foster it and how we avoid a sense of despair and burnout is a really important one, and one that we think a lot about. And it's one of the reasons that we, you know, really wrote this book with an eye toward at least half the book being about solutions and the final chapter of the book being about painting a picture of an aspirational vision of the bright future that we could have if we get these things right. And, you know, I think in general the environmental movement has maybe been a little bit guilty of tending toward the sort of apocalyptic and catastrophic in the messages that we've communicated, and not done a good enough job at talking about, you know, what it would look like if we get these things right. And personally, I actually have a lot of hope. I think there's no reason why, you know, in 100 years my grandchildren or their children couldn't live in a world where, you know, life expectancy and health metrics are as good as they've been in human history, where literacy rates continue to improve, where more and more people have been pulled out of poverty and into the middle class, which has been the trend over the last 70 years, where there's more equity across, you know, gender and race than we've ever seen as a global society, but where we also are starting to get these environmental challenges right. And, you know, there's no question that over the next 100 years we're going to have to decarbonize the energy economy. We're already making huge strides in doing that and moving toward renewable energy. Human population is likely to stabilize over the next 50 years or so, and then start to fall, not through any disaster or any coercion, but simply through the natural demographic transition as more and more girls get educated and there's more economic opportunity for women and more access to family planning for couples who want it. And as population falls, that helps to reduce some of this pressure on the planet, and we're going to need to transition toward, you know, producing food and manufacturing goods in ways that are, you know, dramatically more efficient in their use of resources. But we know how to do that. We're going to need to embrace a circular economy in the business sector, but already we're starting to do that. And so it's easy to imagine a world 100 years from now where, with each passing decade, there's actually more breathing room for the rest of the biosphere, for the rest of life on Earth. And really, it's a question of what we do right now, what we do over the next generation to change the trajectory that we're on. And so that's why there's such an emphasis on solutions. But I think that when you lay out that more aspirational vision of where we're trying to go, it actually does counter the sense of despair and hopelessness that sometimes comes with really delving deeply into some of these questions.
Hmm. Where we are right now in our conversation reminds me of something that would on the surface seem to have little, if anything, to do with the topic at hand. But I recently interviewed an author on the very pressing issue of racial justice and racism in America. And this happened to be an author or a writer who at several points in their book states rather bluntly that that almost nothing has changed when it comes to this whole field or concern. And that was something with which I took some issue, at the risk of seeming insensitive to the reality of racism that is, of course, so much with us. But it seems to me that disregarding the undeniable progress that has been made is a mistake on a couple of different levels. And one of the mistakes is that it doesn't allow the building upon progress which has occurred, past successes which have made a difference in many people's lives. It's easy to disregard that if you didn't live at a time when life was very, very different and might not be aware of the changes that have come. And it seems to me that what you are talking about in your book, Planetary Health, is probably similar in that the victories and triumphs and reversals that have made a difference must be acknowledged, not just for the sake of boosting our sense of hope, but that is also a very real ingredient in continued progress. I mean, we need to know at least those relatively few instances in which we've done some things right.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And again, I think in the environmental community, we've been a little guilty of not telling enough of the positive stories. I mean, I grew up and live in New England, and you know, I'm always struck at how little play the positive stories get. You know, we've been going to this lake since I was about 5 years old, and somewhere around, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, bald eagles started coming back to this lake, and they've been nesting there ever since. And the bald eagle population is way back, and ospreys are coming back to Cape Cod, and air quality is dramatically better in New England than it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and forests are much more extensive, and there's much more carbon sequestration. And, you know, that doesn't belie the fact that globally those trends are probably going in the other direction, but it's important to notice that we woke up in, you know, 1962, thanks to Rachel Carson, to what was happening to bird populations from DDT, and we did something about it from a policy standpoint, and it worked. And, you know, the raptors are back, and or at least they're well on their way back, and that's a victory. And, you know, I think today we're in this odd place where, with one hand, we need to hold the depth of the urgency around the challenges we face and how much is at stake, and not downplay how important it is to get this right. We're on a very, very dangerous course. But with the other hand, we need to hold the understanding that we can actually change that course, and that there's hope if we get it right. And they're slightly uncomfortable sort of bedfellows, these two feelings that we're trying to hold on to at the same time, but they're both part of the reality that we're in.
Dr. Sam Myers is co-editor of the book Planetary Health: Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves, published by Island Press. It's 8:43. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is from the archives, my 2007 conversation with Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary. Peter Yarrow is singing a virtual concert tonight, a benefit for the Uptown neighborhood of Kenosha, a benefit concert sponsored by Downtown Kenosha. You can go to downtownkenosha.org for more information. In the meantime, here's my conversation with Peter Yarrow. And what a pleasure and honor, maybe a thrill actually is a better word, to describe the sense of privilege I have in speaking today for the next few minutes with renowned singer and songwriter Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary fame, who has now, to his credit, a beautiful children's book based on what is perhaps the best known of any of the songs of Peter, Paul, and Mary, Puff the Magic Dragon. And there's an absolutely gorgeous, wonderful children's book which has just been released, which is based upon this beautiful, famous song published by Sterling. And we're going to be talking for the next few minutes about what it feels like for this song to take on a new life in this particular form. And Peter Yarrow, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, my brother. It's a great pleasure to talk to you. You know, the song was actually written in 1959 when I was at Cornell University during exam period with my friend Lenny Lipton. And Peter, Paul, and Mary recorded it and was released in 1962. And it was just a children's song on the album. The first album that we did had other children's songs. It's Raining, It's Pouring, and Autumn to May. And then we always did a children's song or two, and actually did a couple of children's albums. But this song has had a life of its own. And now, do you have the book there, by the way?
I do.
All right. Well, if you look at the last couple of illustrations, next to the last illustration on the right-hand side, you will see Puff the Magic Dragon. But who do you see on the left-hand side, other than Puff the Magic Dragon and Jackie Paper, who might be there? Take a look and see if you can find it.
Well, there's a tree that has come to life, and there's some flowers in the corner that come to life.
Is there a human being there?
There's a little girl.
A little girl? What? Why would a little girl be there? Turn to the next page.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. There she is, loving Puff, and behind the tree on the right, there is somebody who looks like Jackie Paper grown up. I wonder who that little girl is.
I wonder.
Maybe it's Jackie Paper's daughter.
So this is living on in new generations.
And actually, exactly. There's, if you listen to the song, I don't know if you can play it, but you will hear me singing it with my daughter. And it has a totally different feel because we're singing the songs that are in the CD on the album, which include Froggy Winnicorton and The Blue Tail Fly, two of the first songs I ever learned and played on the, and sang on the guitar. You will hear it's as if we're sitting there, and the difference between it, for instance, if I'm sitting there singing Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea, that's the way I sing it on the Peter Paul and Mary record. I'm kind of feeling it and introspective about it. But on the record, you'll hear my daughter, who has a five-month-old, a girl by the name of Valentina. And it's as if we're sitting and singing to a group of kids, and we're singing. Together they would travel on a boat with the Lord's sail. We're telling the story in a different way, rather than performing it as performers. And that's very special, to make a record. My daughter, Bethany Arrow, is an extraordinary singer, and her musical partner, Rufus Cappadocia, who plays the cello, is virtually the third voice on these records. And we've made a CD that's coming out, too. It's the most, I got to tell you, the most exciting thing you can do as a parent is actually do something that you create with your child and your partners when you're adults. It's the most incredible experience.
Well, and I should think it should be very exciting for you to also turn back to something that dates back to long before you were even thinking about being a parent.
Well, and it was long before I could think. Actually, it was long before I was thinking about being a parent. And the most amazing aspect of this is that we are actually doing some singing together. She tours herself, you know, with Rufus Cappadocia, but sometimes we perform together. And indeed, we're going to be doing some touring in the wake of the success of this book. It's already clearly been indicated that it's going to be a number one children's book, which is a huge, just a wonderful surprise. But when you look at it and you see the quality and the beauty of the art by Eric Puybarre, he's French, and he really got the spirit of who Puff and Hanalei are. I wrote him a long dissertation about my feelings about Puff and Hanalei, and he just threw himself into it and outdid himself. It's amazing. I was at the American Booksellers Association, and I was supposed to sign books for an hour. 3.5 hours later, I stumbled to my feet, and the line had been a half an hour long. People were so excited. I think in this era of cynicism and a national sport, being made of ridicule and humiliation of people that people watch on television. That something which is so fraught with sincerity and goodness of intent is resonating very powerfully, and that makes me feel so proud.
Sure. How much credit do you deserve for sort of the final finished form of this book? I mean, how much did you have to do with that? Or were you, or was it more an exercise in faith and trust in others to take this beautiful song and treat it kindly and carefully in converting it into a book?
It's a very good question and very appreciated, because the word thank you or I'm sorry, you know, it doesn't come to people's lips all that easily in this world of ours today. And it gives me an opportunity to tell you that Charlie Nirenberg is not the, you know, the CEO of Sterling. He is a great, wonderful, creative, sensitive guy with the sense of, he got the sense of this. He went for it. I had very little to do with this book. And the editor, whose name is Frances Gilbert, who was Canadian initially, she's a genius. Between the two of them, it's like finding Paul and Mary. I found people I could totally trust and believe in. And in this world, when it's a commercial product and you have to watch your back like crazy, knowing that you can trust somebody to do something so beautifully and so without any compromises is an incredible experience. And I'm looking forward to the next books we're doing, which are Day is Done and Light One Candle. And my daughter and I and her cellist, musical partner, are going to be doing four 12-song illustrated song collections of folk songs and for kids. And we're already working on it. So that'll be 48. It'll be a whole library. And that'll, I think, be a factor in bringing that music into a new kind of focus. We need that kind of spirit in our country. We need it everywhere.
Hmm. And, of course, there is so much to be found in that rich tradition of folk music that is still with us, but especially some of the new music that was created in that spirit of folk music that so powerfully shaped this country and gave voice to a lot of what people were thinking about and dreaming about and fearing at that moment in time when you and your good friends came to prominence.
Well, you know, that's my perspective as well. I feel that the era of the 60s and 70s was really not so much about flower children and long hair and smoking pot. It was really about a search for authenticity, a search for a way of life in which we didn't lie to each other. We really, there were some societal lies that had to be severely looked at. For instance, how could we say the Pledge of Allegiance with liberty and justice for all without being totally dishonest? If we, in the era in which I was in high school and college, when you couldn't go to our nation's capital and sit down at a lunch counter with a person of color, when separate bathrooms for whites and Negroes only, when there was a lynching every 3 days, and when Marian Anderson, the Metropolitan Opera singer, was not allowed to sing at Constitution Hall in our nation's capital, and we could say, what kind of hypocrisy is that with liberty and justice for all? That wasn't the case. We had to look at that. That was a hypocritical lie, societal lie. Men and women were not respectful to each other. Women were not given the opportunity to be part of the American way of life in an equal sense to that of men, and on and on. And that's what came out of that era, that we need to authentically deal with each other. We have to think for ourselves and feel what we feel. And essentially, it is my premise that that is the basis of what will make democracy work and make us a moral nation. Mm. Because we have to develop our emotional intelligence as well as our academic intelligence. We have to allow kids to feel, to think strategically. And that's why my work now is so focused on something called Operation Respect, which is all about creating an atmosphere in the schools and classrooms that is supportive of the needs of all the needs of a child, the emotional, social, and academic needs. And we have that program called Don't Laugh at Me, which uses a lot of this music, including Puff, in 22,000 schools and in Hong Kong and in South Africa and Croatia. Now we're going to Israel. It's been translated into Hebrew, and it's going to be translated into Arabic. You know, my life is as exciting and meaningful as it ever was, and in one special way, more so, because I'm a grandfather and I'm singing with my daughter. And when you hear this song with my daughter and me singing together, you'll understand why it's not just same old Puff. It's Puff with another sense of its validity and importance today, perhaps greater than ever.
Hmm. Well, in this song, which at its heart is about someone slipping away, growing up, and the dragon slipping away sadly, missing their friend, and this, the very creation of this book sort of talks about the circling back, that even when we grow up and we leave something, that so often we return to it, and sometimes with a daughter or a granddaughter in tow, and it all goes on.
And that's why Puff lives forever. And if you ever wondered, and people did, well, what happened to Puff? He was so sad. And the kids really feel bad about that. But the truth of the matter is, as I said, you look at the last two pages and you see, my goodness, that's what happened.
Mm.
It continues, and that good feeling continues. And that we have to continue to believe and to hope and try as adults. It may not be believing in dragons, but we gotta keep from becoming so cynical that we say there's nothing we can do about it. We have to deal with the problems of our world, and we must do what we can to make sure that those unfairnesses and that suffering that's around us is our business, and we deal with it, and we know that we are all connected. Now, I sound like some imbecilic Pollyanna, you know, moralizing guy, but frankly, when you're looking at life and you've lived all these kinds of efforts that I have with Paul and Mary, you know darn well that that dream has not died. That hope has not died. Every time I sing with my daughter, every time I sing with Paul and Mary, by the way, Mary has survived leukemia, and we are performing again.
Mm. Good news.
Yeah, absolutely.
The book is Puff the Magic Dragon, and it is published by Sterling, and what a pleasure to speak with one of the gentlemen responsible for this wonderful song, Peter Yarrow. Very best wishes to you.
My brother, thank you for all this time. It's been a pleasure.
And again, tonight, Peter Yarrow is performing a virtual benefit concert on the invitation of Downtown Kenosha Incorporated, Uptown, Downtown, One Town, a online benefit concert this evening. And you can go to Downtown Kenosha's website, which is downtownkenosha.org, if you would like to make get more information and pledge a gift of support for the rebuilding effort in the Uptown neighborhood of Kenosha.